This is the BBC.
I'm Helen Lewis of the New Statesman, and this is The Week in Westminster. This week we'll be talking about social care, grammar schools, and Philip Hammond's economic vision. This week, Philip Hammond stood up to give his first and last spring budget. From next year, there will be just one major financial statement from the Treasury, delivered in the autumn. On Wednesday, the Chancellor said his Treasury team had reminded him that a predecessor had also had this bright idea. Norman Lamont.
The then Prime Minister described it as the right budget at the right time from the right Chancellor. What they failed to remind me, Mr Deputy Speaker, was that 10 weeks later he was sacked.
On the day, deadpan jokes like this went down a treat with the Tory backbenchers. But then Philip Hammond walked out of the chamber and straight into a storm over his decision to raise Class 4 national insurance contributions on the self-employed. Here's Tory backbencher Andrew Murrison on Wednesday afternoon.
It's very important to ensure that we don't disadvantage self-employed people. This party on this side always has been, and I hope always will be, the party that supports white van man, and may I say on this particular day also white van woman.
And his fellow Conservative Amory Trevelyan on the Today programme the day after.
This is both a break in our manifesto commitment, which clearly is something I do not support, but it goes against the whole essence of what Conservatives believe in, which is encouraging those to take responsibility, to set up businesses, to be the nursery for growth for future larger businesses.
With up to 20 Conservative MPs signalling their willingness to rebel, the government was in trouble. On Thursday, the Prime Minister defended the tax rise, but pledged not to legislate for it until the autumn. It felt as if she was buying herself some time. But perhaps the strangest thing about the national insurance row was the size of the sums involved. The tax hike will raise just £145 million a year. Under the radar, the budget contained some much bigger, and some might say scarier, numbers than that. The first was the extra £2 billion, promised over 3 years to ease the social care crisis. Although that sounds like a pretty healthy amount of cash, it's only intended to plug a funding gap while more radical, long-term solutions are chewed over and presented in a green paper. As a measure of just how much money is needed, it's worth noting that the government has also allowed local authorities which provide social care to put up council tax by an extra 3% starting next month. So is the government doing enough? I was joined in the studio by Conservative MP Alistair Burt, who previously served as Minister of State for Social Care. Down the line was pensions campaigner Ros Altman, who was made a Tory peer by David Cameron. I began by asking Baroness Altman if the crisis was mostly about money.
It isn't just about more money, and the Chancellor is absolutely right to point that out. Yes, you can throw more money at the system, but if the system itself isn't working properly, then that's not a solution. What we need is to change the way we think about what constitutes care and what constitutes healthcare so that we have this better integration, and that if older people need looking after because their health is much more frail, the fact that we have an artificial distinction and it's a bit of a lottery, depending on how you become unwell, the taxpayer might foot the entire bill or none of it at all, is really at the heart of this problem. The fact that we leave this thing called social care to cash-strapped councils dates back to the Poor Laws. But society has changed radically since then, and our National Health Service was really designed as a make-you-better service, you know, a healthcare system where you got ill and the healthcare system made you better and you went back to work. The idea that it was also going to become a look-after-you-forever service was never envisaged by Beveridge when he set up our system.
So one of the other things that Philip Hammond said, apart from this extra bit of money, is a green paper coming to consider, you know, big blue sky thinking on this. Alistair, but from your perspective, what are the things that are kind of seen at the moment as being too radical to discuss but would make a difference, should be on the table here?
Well, the first thing that's got to be on the table is we're all going to have to pay a bit more. But as Roz says, that's not the only answer. There will be plenty of other things to consider. The introduction of new technology into care will make a difference. Caring for people in their own home will become very different. There'll be more multi-generational households. But ultimately, I think one of the radical ideas should be that when people begin work, they're going to have to pay into something extra for social care, and it builds up over their lifetime. I think at some stage you've got to consider some mechanism of introducing more money, and it will have to come from people. The radical idea is to say to people, you may actually have to pay a bit more, instead of trying to pretend that everything can be done at nil cost, or only if you shave things off other things, everything will be fine. I don't think so, and I think we'll recognise if we want the healthcare that we're going to need as we get older, we may have to put a bit into it.
Rosamund, I just want to ask you about one thing. This is the death tax idea. This is a levy on estates paid after death, which Labour were talking about. George Osborne kind of killed that idea in his 2010 election campaign. Is that something that should be back on the table?
Well, Philip Hammond killed the idea again. I don't think that is on the table. But the heart of this problem is that despite the ageing population, which we have known about for decades, there is absolutely no money, not really a penny, set aside either in the public accounts or in private families to pay for care as you get older. When it comes to social care, and at the point when you need care, you can't just tell people, oh, I'm sorry, why don't you wait till you're a bit older, as we're trying to do with pensions. They actually need to have some money. And that's why Alistair's right. You know, for younger people, building this into a form of national insurance arrangement that will provide later life care, but you pay into it over many, many years, so you help cover the cost, does make sense. What I would like to see, though, is that those baby boomers who are heading for this crisis themselves very soon, and many of whom are already retired, they often will have some kind of savings, whether it's ISAs, whether it's private pensions. And at the moment, they have no idea that they're going to potentially have to find thousands of pounds all of a sudden to pay for later life care. So I think we need to signal to families, and that's where we could have some incentives from the Chancellor, that you might want to keep some of the savings you've got aside in case you need care. You know, the current cohort of people needing care who are causing this unbelievable crisis that's creating havoc in the NHS is a relatively small proportion of the population. But when the baby boomers who are currently sort of in their 60s come to the point when they will need care, that demographic is massive.
Well, I mean, you thought a national insurance rise was controversial. I mean, the idea of telling baby boomers that they're going to have to dip their hands into their pockets for something they thought was going to be free is going to be difficult, isn't it, Alistair Burt?
It is, but this is where the challenge is. If we have a culture where people believe that once you hit 65, that's it, your neighbours, let's be quite honest, it's not the government that picks up your bill, it's your neighbours will now care for you as you get older, I think it's unfair to suggest that for those who have been able to do reasonably well in life, they should at the age of 65 believe all that money is theirs and they don't have a responsibility to pay for their own care. Some will need it and some won't. That's why Ros is right. There has to be an incentive to save. There has to be a point to you using your own money. And you must be able to deal with it as you want if you don't actually need it. It doesn't all go to the state.
An important point to make, perhaps, is that actually families are already paying for it. The problem is they don't know about it until the point at which it happens, and they therefore have no incentive to prepare for that. It comes as a terrible shock, but it's almost like a wealth tax on those who happen to get ill. And of course, because councils don't pay enough to cover the costs of the people who do get paid for by the state, which is subject to a very draconian means test, those particular people who already face a tax on their wealth to pay for the care that they didn't realise they might need to pay for also face an extra tax, a sort of stealth tax, because they also have to cross-subsidise the underpayments.
Absolutely.
By paying extra for their own care. This system is broken. It simply isn't working.
That was Baroness Altman and Alistair Burt on social care. Now here's a riddle. When is a grammar not a grammar? When it's a selective free school, of course. The spring budget promised £320 million in this parliament to help fund up to 140 new schools, with the intention that some will practice academic selection. Overturning Tony Blair's 1998 ban on new grammar schools is catnip to some Tories, but is fiercely opposed by Labour. The budget also proposed the creation of a new technical qualification, nicknamed T-levels. So, is this a quiet education revolution, or just tinkering around the edges? I was joined by the Conservative MP Graham Brady, who is a keen backer of grammar schools, and Lucy Powell, the former Labour Shadow Education Secretary. I asked Lucy why Labour was so opposed to grammar schools.
Well, the evidence is really clear that they do nothing for social mobility and they do nothing for raising attainment, especially for those who don't get into the grammar schools. In fact, they make those gaps wider. And really, the challenge we face is how do we ensure we've got a better education for all children, and often those who aren't achieving at the age of either 11 or 5 or at other ages. And all the evidence shows us that selective systems widen that gap, they don't narrow it.
OK, so Graham Brady, what's your response to that?
Well, first of all, the best performing LEAs are disproportionately selective ones, and that's not just grammar schools, it's grammar schools and high schools together. But I do think it's very important that we should make sure that we have the widest possible spectrum of children having the opportunity to go to grammar school, if that's the right kind of education for them. I would like to see a much bigger effort for grammar schools, especially the new ones I hope to see, reaching out to get more people from different backgrounds taking the test.
OK, so we have this announcement in the budget, £320 million for 114 new free schools, which, you know, will include some of them to be selective. You know, that's still a very small amount of money in school funding terms. Were you happy with that announcement?
Absolutely. I think, you know, this is something that is a big and important change, but it needs to be done carefully. It needs to be done incrementally over time. I think we need to make it very clear to people that we're not talking about a dramatic reorganisation of education across the country. We're talking about starting to increase the choices that are available to people regardless of their means, just providing a little bit more fairness in society by doing that.
And Lucy Powell, so Labour Party scrapped the creation of new grammars in 1998, but polling still suggests that they are still incredibly popular. I mean, 60% of people, I think, in an independent survey last year. Why has Labour failed to make its case on this?
I mean, I'm not sure how popular they really are amongst parents. I think there is a lot of romanticism about grammar schools and about a previous era of education. All the leading educational experts, they know that creaming off the best pupils in an area has a dramatic effect on the whole ecosystem of that area. And in Kent, which is a fully selective area, just 27% of children on free school meals get the 5A to C benchmark. Whereas in comprehensive London, it's 45% of children on free school meals get that same benchmark.
This shouldn't be about forcing a big reorganisation of education. What we do want to see is that greater diversity, especially, I would say, to see some of those new selective schools in some urban areas, some more deprived areas, areas perhaps where there's really very little choice of good school all too often today, and will open some opportunities for children who need them.
And Graham Brady, let's just talk a little bit about tea levels. I mean, people have said, you know, Philip Hammond doesn't have a way with jokes. I think maybe he wishes he'd made a few, slightly fewer jokes in the budget now. But tea levels is a kind of a great catchy name for what is new technical education qualifications. That's something that you welcome.
Very much. And you know, I think in many ways this is the flip side of academic selection. What we should be doing is making sure that people are getting the right kind of education that's going to benefit them most. And the big problem we've had in our country, probably for 150 years, is that technical education has been woefully undervalued. And I think the public is ahead or perhaps of the educational system on this now. There is a much greater willingness to look at different streams, different directions in which our children might go and which might suit them best. I think also the move to have more degree-level apprenticeships is a really important and strong part of what's being proposed.
And Lucy Powell, is this Labour Party view as well that we need to do more? I know that there's been some rumblings in Labour about the squeeze on further education as a concept.
Well, I think the devil will be in some of the detail, because I do think that what the government are proposing is that you either go down a technical vocational route or you go down an academic route at the age of 16. And it gets back to the same debate a bit about grammar schools, that you're either academically able or you're not, when the truth is you often have a mix of both. And actually many of the jobs of the future are about a mix of both. I've pressed the government on this in Parliament. You know, I hope that we don't start closing off options to young people, but that we use these new technical levels to enable more children to reach their full potential and to give them second, third and fourth chances if necessary, and we don't close off options.
That was Lucy Powell and Graham Brady on the future of education. Hansard shows that Philip Hammond did not mention the word Brexit once during his 55-minute budget speech, which might have felt to some of us like a blessed relief. But leaving the European Union is still the government's biggest challenge, and no one will be watching the negotiations more closely than the car industry. Britain made 1.7 million cars last year, and access to the single market is vital if we want to sell those to our European neighbours. Last October, the chief executive of Nissan met Theresa May personally to seek assurances about the future of the Nissan plant in Sunderland. I was joined by two MPs whose constituencies have deep links to the motor industry. Gavin Shuker is Labour MP for Luton South, where Vauxhall employs 1,500 people. Vauxhall has just been sold by the American company General Motors to the French-owned PSA, which also owns Peugeot and Citroën. Julian Knight, meanwhile, is Conservative MP for Solihull, home of Jaguar Land Rover. I began by asking him, how important is the car industry to the UK?
It's a crucial industry because it employs something like 700,000 people across the UK. 80% of components in a car can actually be made in the UK, so it's a really key part of an industrial base. And also in my constituency of Solihull, we have the flagship plant for Jaguar Land Rover, which employs upwards of 9,000 on a 300-acre site, and obviously is a big success story. To such an extent, you could say, sort of exporting to China, for instance, is almost off the bonnet of a Jaguar Land Rover.
And Gavin Shuker, you've got the Vauxhall plant, which employs 1,500 people in your constituency. Vauxhall's just been passed, essentially, from an American company to a French-owned company. How confident are you about those jobs and the future of that plant?
Well, I'm pretty confident in the short and medium term that would be fine in Luton. You know, it's one of the most efficient and profitable parts of the new company as it comes together. But, you know, it's the plant where my dad worked and his dad before him. That's still quite a common Luton story. So we need to safeguard these jobs. They're, in a sense, the right kind of jobs. You know, they're jobs where you can skill yourself up and you can raise a decent wage. And we know that all too few jobs these days provide that.
So the Peugeot Citroën PSA CEO, Carlos Tavares, said he was going to try and make £1.5 billion in savings in a speedy way. What reassurances should the government be giving to workers in those plants?
Well, we've got reassurances from the new owners of the plant, obviously, that they're going to see production through. But government also has to make assurances in this case. You know, you saw the deal up for Nissan in the northeast. In a sense, what they had to do was de-risk the risks of Brexit. Now, those risks haven't gone away here in the UK either. And if you're a transnational company looking to put investment in, you're going to choose the place with the lowest risk and the best return. So it's really going to come down to the kind of deal that we have on Brexit that gives us an answer as to whether or not these plants have a long-term future.
Julian Knight, we never really found out exactly what Nissan got from the government, but what is the car industry asking for generally?
I think the car industry basically wants a bit of certainty. It wants to ensure that we have a continued mutual beneficial access to the European single market. And also, I think the car industry is very interested in what the government's saying about the industrial strategy, trying to emphasise the skills agenda. Because one of the biggest problems we actually have in Solihull and within Jaguar Land Rover is actually recruiting the right people, finding people with the right skills. And so I think it's really important that as a private sector and also as a government as well, that we come together in order to skill up so that basically we have people in order to fill these new roles.
Well, let's not do what Philip Hammond did in budget this week. Let's mention the B word, Brexit. The Guardian this week had the story of the mini crankshaft. So it says it crosses the channel three times. It's made in France, then it's milled in Britain, then it's sent to Munich to assent it in the engine, then it's back to Oxford for the engine to be put in the car. Gavin Shuker, that's going to be a lot more difficult after Brexit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the reality is, so we build the last white van in this country here in Luton. 60% of those parts are purchased in euros and sourced overseas. We've benefited from the fact that we've been a continuous area without tariffs to build, and that's been a key part of the success story that's been automotive over the last 10 or 20 years. Whatever deal we end up with in Brexit, if we disrupt that pattern, you know, this is what Brexit looks like. It won't be a big bang. It will be the slow starvation of investment in countries such as the UK.
One thing I think is really important to emphasise here is exactly the importance the UK domestic market is to our European competitors. I mean, the average car on a UK road is 6 years old. On a German road, it's 10 years old. In America, it's 11 to 12 years old. We replace our cars much more frequently. So for 65 million people, we actually punch far more above our weight than other European countries. And that's the reason why, in European car circles, the UK has been referred to quite amusingly as Treasure Island.
So why do we replace our cars more frequently? We're not just more flash than Europeans, right?
Well, no, obviously we're British, we're restrained in that respect. But I think it's actually to do with the interaction between finance and car ownership. We have a thing called a PCP, which is a personal contract plan, which a lot of people get their cars with or through. And that basically allows people to change their cars more frequently for a monthly payment. Now, there are such plans in other countries, but the interaction between the car industry and the finance industry is nowhere near as sophisticated as in Britain. And that's one of the key reasons why, actually, OK, we may be 65 million people, but if you look at the numbers of cars being sold, we're right up there with the top markets in the world.
And Gavin Chuka, there's been a lot of discussion this week about Vauxhall as a kind of great British brand. But, you know, as we said, it's moved from an American owner to a French owner. Jaguar Land Rover is owned ultimately by an Indian company. There aren't any British-owned mass car manufacturers here at all. Are we too lax about letting our crown jewels of our industry be bought up from abroad?
Yeah, I think we probably are, in all honesty. And certainly if we're going into this new Brexit future, we're going to have a serious discussion about what parts of industry are vital to be British-owned and where we want foreign direct investment from outside. You know, in Vauxhall's case, actually, they've been owned since the 1920s by the Americans. But it hasn't changed people's perceptions of it as a British brand, because obviously we build cars here in the UK. Now, if I were up in Ellesmere Port right now, looking at a decision on a new Astra coming in, perhaps the back end of 2018, that's when that decision will need to be made, I would probably be more nervous, because we're not going to know the shape of the Brexit deal by that point. And that is going to be the key thing that determines whether or not we continue to build here in the UK into the future.
Gavin Chuka and Julian Knight on Brexit and the car industry. The post-budget front pages might have been bloody, but if Philip Hammond seemed unruffled, that's not just his deadpan spreadsheet fill demeanour. The Chancellor is, we're told, far less concerned with personal popularity than his ambitious and supremely political predecessor George Osborne. So how could a Chancellor, who seems so cautious, have produced a budget which has provoked such strong reactions? And what kind of economic vision does he have for Britain? The former Lib Dem MP Norman Baker worked with Philip Hammond in the Department for Transport, while Conservative MP Hugo Swire worked with him at the Foreign Office. First of all, I asked Hugo Swire, what kind of Tory is Philip Hammond?
Well, I think he's rather an old-fashioned type of Tory, really. He cuts a slightly old-fashioned figure, but I think he's a very practical man. He's an enormously likeable man, I think. And this is a man who's now held several of the great offices of state. I mean, he's been Secretary of State for Transport, which perhaps isn't the great office of state, but he's been Secretary of State for Defence, which certainly is. He's been the Foreign Secretary and now Chancellor of the Exchequer. So in terms of building up a political pedigree, he's certainly qualified to take on really any job in government now.
Norman Baker, it seems to me he's held a lot of maybe not the most glamorous kind of ministries. You worked with him at Transport. What was he like there?
Well, he didn't like Liberals, that's the first thing to say. He was quite difficult as a coalition Secretary of State to deal with. But the thing about Philip was that he didn't really know much about transport when he came. He was expecting to be Chief Secretary to the Treasury. That's what he prepared himself for in opposition, and of course there was then a coalition. So he had a reasonably blank sheet of paper to work from. And although he was naturally suspicious of me and my party, what I found was if you persuaded him, and he was open-minded, if you sat there and persuaded him of an issue, he would then buy it, and he would then take that forward to Cabinet and deliver it. I got on with him fine. I mean, we had major policy discussions, of course, as you'd expect. But in the end of the day, transport wasn't particularly a difficult issue for the coalition. It was one where we both wanted to see growth. He's a great believer in infrastructure projects, as indeed am I, and he was quite happy to see the area I was covering, which was rail and bus, left largely to me on the basis he was more interested in cars and planes.
Fair enough. Hugo Swire, he tweeted a picture of himself preparing for the budget with a totally immaculate desk. Not a thing on it, not a Byron burger a la George Osborne. Absolutely nothing. His reputation is someone who's quite meticulous. Is that what you found working with him?
I think he's very meticulous. He's very thorough. He's very well organised. And I agree with Norman. I think his approach is interesting. I think he likes an argument. Philip, I think, argues or rejects what you say in order to make you make your point in a better way to him. And I think if you make your point to him, he's very willing to take that on board.
His nickname, we heard, was Spreadsheet Phil, which he alluded to in the budget, where he did a joke about this is the spreadsheet bit coming and, you know, I've got a reputation to protect. Norman Baker, in your book Against the Grain, you tell this story about him joking that you and Theresa Villiers, another minister, should share a tandem after he discovered that you both cycled.
Yes.
There were quite a few more jokes than I think anybody was expecting in the budget. Is he quite a funny guy?
I think he is quite amusing. He's a bit deadpan. The story about the tandem, of course, was he asked a question which neither Theresa nor I expected, which was who's at the front of the tandem, who's at the back, as to what measures that would give about cycling policy or the Department for Transport.
Just the optics.
Well, the optics, indeed, and absolutely so, and I suppose it's a fair point in some ways.
Which end has to do the most work?
Well, I think probably, as with the Coalition, the Liberals did all the work and it's always got the credit at the front of the bike. But Hugo's right, he had a meticulous eye for detail, and he would spot errors. But sometimes I thought that he missed the wood for the trees just because of that. He always talked about heads of budget heads having haircuts and he wanted to find out where you could save money. Well, that's fine. I wanted to save money as well. But sometimes the haircut wasn't necessary. And I think sometimes cuts were made that were actually counterproductive and cost more money in the end because he was zealous about saving money. We were all charged in those days with cutting budgets. But nevertheless, I think sometimes that they didn't think through, on occasions, the consequences of particular savings he made.
Hugo Squire.
Well, I think to revert to your earlier question, what kind of Conservative is he? I think he's instinctively a small government Conservative who, even if the budgetary situation didn't demand it, would always look to ways of reducing the costs of government. He also looks through, I think, the prism of a self-made businessman. I mean, he's rumoured to have made himself quite a decent amount of money, and good luck to him. But he's done that as a businessman, so therefore I think he has a very business approach to government. I think that's what comes through time and time again.
If you had to put money on it, would you characterise his relationship with Theresa May as more Blair Brown or more Cameron Osborne?
Well, I'm, alas, no longer an insider in the hallowed halls of Number 10, so I just don't know, and I certainly haven't asked him that. I would say they have probably a good, close working relationship. What it's like on the personal front, I just don't know.
They are quite near neighbours in constituency terms, and I always got the impression when I was in government that they got on, albeit they didn't clash very much in departments, they got on pretty well. In terms of your contrast, I mean, it's certainly more functional than Blair and Brown, which was totally dysfunctional by the end. And in terms of Cameron and Osborne, I mean, Cameron was quite laid back and Osborne took a lot of the decisions, which actually I regret it because I prefer Cameron's decisions to Osborne's personally. So I think it's different. And Theresa is behaving as she did at the Home Office, is very predictable in terms of what she's doing. And Philip, in a way, is behaving as he did in the departments he was in. So to me, there's no surprises as to how they're behaving. Philip is very competent in terms of his financial acumen. And when he was appointed to Minister of Defence, I, for one, thought it was a brilliant appointment because the Ministry of Defence has been chronically overspent for decades. And here was the one person, I think, who had both the capability and the guts to take on the Ministry of Defence.
Norman Baker and Hugo Squire on The Man Controlling the Treasury. That's all for me. I'm curling up for the weekend with Philip Hammond's big book of budget side splitters.
Under the last Labour government, corporation tax was 28%. By the way, they don't call it the last Labour government for nothing.
I'll have them rolling in the aisles. In the chair next week is Steve Richards. You've been listening to me, Helen Lewis, of The New Statesman.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.